From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Cheryl Corley. A $700 billion economic bailout plan is headed for the U.S. House after the Senate overwhelmingly voted for the measure last night. Now, House lawmakers are scrambling to garner enough support for the bill that representatives rejected earlier this week. And for the latest on the economic bailout, we're joined now by NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Cheryl. Good to be with you.
Yeah. So tell us, Ron, what made this bill so successful in the Senate? The vote was 74 to 25.
They changed it, but they didn't really fundamentally change it. They didn't really go back to the drawing board, as some people said they should do. What they did was they added things to it. And what I would call it would be a kind of a combination of the bludgeon and the bribe. The bludgeon, of course, being all the phone calls that the senators had been receiving from back in their home states from business people saying, we can't borrow any money. We can't do business. We can't meet our payroll. We can't bring in more inventory. We're going to have to shut down. Those kinds of calls. Maybe panicky, maybe hysterical, maybe not totally representative, but a lot of those calls. And that was changing the atmosphere politically because previously most of the calls were in opposition. Now the bribes, lots of bribes. We have the raising of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation insurance on everybody's bank accounts, business people and individuals such as us, from $100,000 to $250,000 per account. That makes a big difference to businesses, and it also makes a big difference to banks because banks are much less likely to see people coming in panic to get their money out if they see that the federal government is moving to shore up the health of those banks.
Mm-hmm. Well, 133 House Republicans voted against the package the first time around. What's going to is this enough to really persuade them to actually vote for it this time?
I think it's risky to predict the behavior of the House Republicans because we've seen before they are deeply wounded. They do feel abused. They feel left out. And they will take opportunities to show everybody how unhappy they are and to make us feel their pain. So we may see that rebellion played out again on Monday. I mean, the one we saw on Monday played out again tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy Pelosi has said she's not going to pass this on Democratic votes. She says she wants 100 Republican votes this time. That would be an increase of 35, or quite a few of that 133 who voted no on Monday. So that's a pretty tall order. We'll see how close they get to that. They will get more Republican votes than they got last time, and maybe that will be enough.
Do some of these Republicans and some Democrats, though, even though we have all this sweetening to this bill, still see this as really bad medicine?
Absolutely. And that's on the left and on the right. You have your most liberal members of the House and Senate and your most conservative members of the House and Senate essentially joining hands, coming 360 on this thing and saying, we're all the populists here. We're not the centrists. We're not the establishment. We're speaking for the angry little guy. And there's some irony in that, perhaps, and some discomfort when you, you know, look over and see who you're in bed with on this thing. But politics makes that kind of bedfellows. And we're certainly seeing it in this particular context.
Ron, we only have a few seconds left, but both Senators Barack Obama and John McCain voted for the provision. Is that good enough cover for them, I guess, during the campaign?
Well, it certainly makes it less of a presidential issue, and that had been a big problem, frankly, in the politics of it last week. Once you inject the White House contest into this, everything kind of tends to blow up.
That was NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He joined me from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Tonight, the vice presidential candidates go head-to-head for their first and only debate. It's been touted as heavily as if it was a battle between former heavyweight boxing titans Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis. Or maybe that's Bobby Riggs versus Billie Jean King, that tennis match way back in 1973. That got quite a bit of publicity as well. But tonight's battle is all about politics. Senator Joe Biden and Governor Sarah Palin are slated to discuss domestic and foreign policy at Washington University in St. Louis. Later in the show, we'll talk about what goes on behind the scenes as campaign teams prepare for debates. But for now, we turn to an expert on the history of presidential debates, Tom Holohan. He is a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. Welcome to News and Notes.
Happy to be here.
Well, we've seen just one debate already between Senators McCain and Obama. How did that one compare with presidential debates of the past?
Well, I thought it was similar to some of the debates of the past. It was a primarily issue-focused debate.
Mm-hmm.
I thought both of the candidates did a fairly good job of achieving what they wanted to achieve. I don't think it was a debate where either candidate made a huge mistake, and that's the primary goal that both candidates always have, to avoid becoming the story because you make a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Of course, these television debates, everybody, there's a lot of battle over whether we should debate, and they are always held. But before television, how much of a call was there for debates leading up to a presidential election?
Well, the first debates between presidential candidates didn't occur until 1960, and the Nixon-Kennedy debates, of course. And then they didn't occur after 1960 until 1976, primarily because they were seen as risky. Mm-hmm. An incumbent who was running well ahead of his opponent didn't want to risk a debate. And in 1976, of course, we had the unique situation of an unelected incumbent who decided that because he was trailing his opponent, he was willing to debate. And we had a challenger who was eager to share the platform with an incumbent president because he thought that would create more credibility for his candidacy.
Well, because you've mentioned that one, I want to play a bit of tape from that. Began in 1976 when President Ford raised eyebrows in his clash with Jimmy Carter when he said this.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Democratic Senator Lloyd Benson, who was putting down Republican nominee Dan Quayle at one of the more memorable vice presidential debates back in 1988. We also heard Ronald Reagan making light of his opponent, Walter Mondale, in 1984. A few examples there of memorable comments made during debates. Which ones stand out for you? What have you heard?
Well, I think all of those comments represent sort of the classic examples of what happens when one quip or one gaffe statement becomes the defining press story in the wake of a debate. And each of those moments illustrate what the candidates, as I say, absolutely need to avoid. As we look forward to tonight's debate, for instance, many people are going to be watching to see whether or not Senator Biden goes on and on and on and stops talking at some point in order to permit space for other people to communicate. And so it's avoiding that kind of expectation of where his weakness lies that will be defining characteristic as to whether or not he's successful. So avoiding the mistake is the most important thing. I think the examples you cite are the classic illustrations of when a mistake occurs. These debates are really in a very strong sense about theater. And so you're battling the expectations of the audience and you're trying to fulfill your strategy and you're trying to shape the news story that appears the next day. You cite, for example, the case of Ford and Poland. Mm-hmm. Initial polling said that people who viewed the debate were not unsympathetic to Ford and, in fact, thought he had acquitted himself rather well in the debate. The public opinion didn't shift until the next two or three days after, as the press accounts of the debate focused almost exclusively on that statement about Poland. And as a result of those press accounts, public attitudes began to shift in the days following the debate, and Ford was presumed to have lost it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you're talking about issues and people really paying attention to them. But in the 1960 debate between Kennedy and Richard Nixon, that really transformed the game, not necessarily, though, because of the issues, though. It was TV and how they looked, was it?
Some fascinating dynamics in that debate. First of all, Nixon had made a pledge to visit all 50 states, and he had recently come back from a trip to Alaska. He didn't wear makeup in that debate. He had battled the flu. He wasn't feeling well. And Kennedy sort of said, well, I'm not going to wear makeup, you know, almost making it sound like it would be a womanly sign of weakness to wear makeup. Kennedy, in contrast, had prepared for the debate.
Or Nixon said that.
No, Kennedy said that to Nixon. Uh-huh. All right. Kennedy, on the other hand, had prepared for the debates in Florida, had played a little golf, had spent a lot of time in the sun. So he went into the studio looking tanned and looking fit. So the contrast just in appearance between Nixon, who badly wanted pancake makeup to cover his beard, and Kennedy, who looked healthful and fit, was profound. Mm-hmm. And what the lesson of that debate was that style matters in many senses as much as substance, and that people are looking for nonverbal as well as verbal cues in evaluating the debaters.
Hmm. Well, we've only seen one other vice presidential debate that was between a man and a woman. And I was wondering what lessons could both candidates learn from the Geraldine Ferraro, George Bush Sr. debate that was held in 1984?
Well, when a male candidate debates a female, he has to be especially sensitive to not appear to be condescending and to be respectful. And there were moments in that Bush-Ferraro debate where Bush seemed to be putting Geraldine Ferraro down and seemed to be saying that she didn't really deserve to be in the position she was in, and there were negative press framings as a result of that. I would expect tonight that Senator Biden, particularly given the history of Hillary Clinton and the relationship between the Clinton voters and the Obama campaign, is going to be profoundly sensitive to that tonight. He is likely not to make any attacks, I would expect, on Governor Palin, but is instead going to make his attacks against Senator McCain and will be focusing on the top of the ticket, assuming that the moderator of the debate will be pressing Governor Palin for answers and that Governor Palin will succeed or fail based upon her own abilities.
All right. Well, that was Tom Holohan, a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. He is also the author of Uncivil Wars, Political Campaigns in a Media Age. And he joined me here in our NPR West studios. This is News and Notes. I'm Cheryl Corley. So as Sarah Palin and Joe Biden get ready to step into the ring for their one and only debate tonight, what goes on behind the scenes to get candidates into top verbal sparring shape? Well, joining me now is Laura Schwartz. She's an independent political commentator and a former special assistant to President Bill Clinton. Hi, Laura.
Hello. It's an exciting night here in St. Louis, Missouri.
I can imagine. Let me stress that you are an independent political commentator now, not an advocate for any party.
That is correct.
Okay. You have been witness to debate preparation sessions, however. So when does the work really start for these events?
Well, I tell you, it's something that's ongoing from the very start of the general election, because the best way to debate effectively is to know what your opponent is going to say.
Uh-huh.
So everyone in each campaign has been paying attention to the interviews the other opponent has been giving, the speeches that they have been making. And about a month ago, they start compiling a briefing book. This is about 4 inches thick. It has tabs covering every issue, everything that the campaign has put out on it, everything your opponent has said about it, and it's a way to get you briefed on all the issues. As you know, tonight, 90 minutes, everything's on the table.
Yeah. So what are the key points a debate prep team likes to address right away? I was wondering if there was like a set list, or does it really depend on the candidate and the race?
Well, hands down, no matter the juxtaposition of your candidate or the charisma they may or may not have, it always comes down to two things, and that's the verbals and the nonverbals. So starting with the nonverbal, you've got to make sure that your candidate is ready to stand 90 minutes under hot, bright lights answering intense questions. So what they do, and this is how they did it with the Joe Biden team in Delaware this week, they take a hotel ballroom, they actually put in a stage, 2 lecterns, the same height as they will be that night. You've got your sparring partner playing the position of the opponent, and you're there under the lights, and you go for 90 minutes at a time, so you're in top form. Sarah Palin's been out at John McCain's ranch in Sedona, Arizona, and actually during her debate prep outside, but they still have those lecterns, and you know, the sun's pretty hot up there as well.
So they're trying to get into the zone for this debate. So how much of a focus is there on like really physical things, like how a person speaks, the way he or she stands, those sorts of things?
They will want to work on cadence. You know, the response time of which you take, it's set out by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to answer the first question. So they're going to want to make sure that you get the points down within those 90 seconds, and you can pretty much see what the topics are going to be. They want to talk about hand gestures. When do you relate to the camera in front of you versus your opponent? Now, for those first 90 seconds that each of them have, you'll see them looking right into that camera, talking to the voter in their living room. Then they've got 90 seconds to talk to each other. Now, last weekend, John McCain came under a lot of fire for never really looking at Barack Obama during the conversation piece. So I think you will see Sarah Palin and Joe Biden looking towards each other for that. And so they'll work on that, as well as the fact that, you know, you don't want to invade the other's face. You have your area at the lectern for a reason. So you're never really going to see Joe Biden or Sarah Palin wandering out of that space.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah Palin, as a politician, of course, has debated before. The stakes are much higher tonight, though. So what extra measures do you think have been taken to get her ready?
Well, I think they've looked at her past interview performances, and they want to keep her away from what I call the ramble. Now, she has a way of answering questions. Sometimes you're not sure if it's because she's not positive on the issue substance, or if she's just trying to pack a lot of information in. Two very easy, you know, potholes to step into. I think they're going to try to keep her crisp, maybe use one or two examples per solution that the McCain team is proposing to the issue at hand, mm-hmm. so that she keeps command of that question. When you look at those two dozen debates she did leading up to the gubernatorial race in Alaska in 06, she does have a pattern of continuing to speak about a subject and using her full time. They may want to bring her back a little bit on that tonight.
I expect you think that Joe Biden will be much briefer in his answers?
Well, he was put to the test earlier this primary debate season when a debate hosted by Brian Williams brought up how verbose, how long-winded, how drawn out Joe Biden can be. And Brian Williams asked if he agreed with that assessment, and Joe Biden simply answered, yes. So that tells us that Joe Biden himself is aware of his problem, and that makes it easier to try to fix, something you can be sure they've been working hard at.
And that is Laura Schwartz, independent political commentator and former special assistant to President Clinton. She joined us from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Just 33 days are left until Election Day, and voter registration deadlines are quickly approaching. And we're kicking off this month's series on voting with a primer we're calling Voting 101, what you need to know to make sure your voice is heard. And joining us today to help spread the facts and dispel myths about the voting process is the national president of the League of Women Voters, Mary Wilson. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
I am quite well, thank you. Well, it's expected that November 4th is going to be a big turnout day. Projections so far say about 130 million people will be heading to the polls. You've met with election officials across the country. Think they're ready?
Well, I have to tell you that the election officials that I've been meeting with are indeed predicting that 80 to 85% turnout, which is truly huge.
Mm-hmm.
And they need probably 30% of the electorate to vote by absentee ballot or early voting in the states that early voting is permissible in order to feel comfortable that they can handle that November 4th crowd at the election. And almost uniformly, all of the election officials have said to me, even if they get that many people voting early, there are going to be lines on election day.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing everything that we can to get out the word to minimize those lines. And one of the best ways is to be informed. It takes you a lot less time to vote.
If you know what you're voting on.
If you are informed ahead of time and take that sample ballot right into the polling booth with you.
Uh-huh. Of course, there are all sorts of myths about voting. We've seen a lot of stories about voting making the email circuit. What are some of the big ones that the League has come across?
Well, we come across that one about, absentee ballots aren't counted unless the election is closed, and nothing can be further from the truth. All ballots are counted as long as the voter is eligible to vote. So go ahead and cast your absentee ballot and be assured that it will be counted.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. I want to go across some of the questions about voting that we've heard, like can you vote if you have outstanding parking tickets or loans?
That's an interesting one. The truth of the matter is I haven't heard that parking tickets are felonies, and in most states the rule is that mm-hmm. if you have been convicted of a felony, you are disenfranchised until you have completed all of your sentence, but then you can get your rights restored.
And having a loan is not a felony either.
And having a loan is definitely not a felony. I will say that there are still a few states that do not restore ex-felons' voting rights. And so one of the best ways to find that out is to go on our vote411.org website, and you can find out what the information is in your particular state about eligibility to vote.
Mm-hmm. Here's one that's been making the email circuit. Can you wear a T-shirt for one of the candidates to the polls if you're going to go in and vote?
That's a very interesting question, and it's a First Amendment freedom of speech question. And I just have to say that this has come up in a number of states. For example, last week when I was visiting with the Florida election director, I asked him that specific question because I kept hearing that down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And he assured me that indeed people could wear campaign T-shirts when they went in as voters, that the prohibition against electioneering did not apply to voters wearing garments. Obviously, you cannot campaign for a candidate inside the polls or within a certain number of feet in most states. And the problem is that some states have indeed interpreted that wearing of campaign paraphernalia as being electioneering or campaigning. And so I have to tell you this. I am encouraging voters to not wear their campaign paraphernalia when they go to vote. And the reason I'm saying that is, yes, there's clearly a freedom of speech issue involved here, but don't be concerned. There are organizations across the country who are looking out for those kinds of civil liberties issues related to voting. It's much more important that you as an individual get to vote, and so don't find yourself in that situation of being turned away from the polls because of wearing campaign paraphernalia.
All right. Well, this Tuesday, voters in Ohio were able to both register and vote on the same day. The state's Republican Party had challenged the law, but it was upheld by the Ohio Supreme Court. Stephen Hightower is joining us now. He's the director of the Ohio chapter of the League of Youth Voters, and the organization has been working to get voters to the polls. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Cheryl. How are you doing today?
I'm well. So tell us briefly about this new early voting in Ohio. How's that going?
There's an exciting change in Ohio's laws that allows for voters with no excuses to cast their votes up to 35 days before the election. And also that coincides with the 30-day registration deadline. So there is a period that we call Golden Week, where voters have the opportunity to register and vote at the same time, going to their local voting center by county in their county.
So, what have you been doing in the last couple of days during this golden time period to get people to the polls?
We've been busy educating the public, providing rides to the polls, and making sure that people know that they have this opportunity. We don't want any voter to be left out. Before the deadline on the 6th, it is important that everybody who has not registered or has changed address to just go on down to their early voting center and cast your ballot so that that can be counted and you don't have any worries and you can enjoy the rest of your fall.
Uh-huh. Mary, I would imagine that the League of Women Voters has also kept a close eye on what's happening in Ohio. Talk to us a little bit about how this all started in the first place. How did the voting law get changed?
The interesting part about that, and I will have to say I was visiting in Ohio week before last, when the whole discussion came up about whether or not this was legally acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the ability to cast the vote and the registration has been on the books for a while. It's just they changed the absentee balloting so that now you do not need an excuse to vote by absentee ballot, but it actually the law actually had been on the books for a while that that caused a an issue with respect to the days prior to the election that absentee, no excuse absentee balloting went into effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 2004, there were, you know, Ohio was a state of controversy. There were really long lines and a lot of electronic machine malfunctions, and state lawmakers responded by easing these rules on early voting. And I was wondering what the league thought about that. What is happening in Ohio? That's a good thing, where you can register and vote same day. Go ahead.
Were you referring to the League of Young Voters? Okay.
Are both leagues. So, yes. So, Stephen, why don't you answer first and then Mary chime in?
Absolutely. We think that any steps to open access to our fundamental right to vote is a great step. And it is so important that that people know about these opportunities. I was in Ohio. I worked at the Ohio State campus, and I was a student in 2004. And the lines were ridiculous, for lack of a better word, because people were standing in lines, some places in Ohio, up to 8 hours. And we all have to work, go to school, and many other things in our lives, take care of relatives. So it's important that voting be as convenient as possible. And while it is not as perfect as it can be, voting early is the easiest way to cast your vote at your time and to have your voice heard.
Mm-hmm. And so we know where the young voters stand on that. Mary, how about the League of Women Voters, this whole concept of registration and voting same day? Is that going to be really good for voters?
Let me just say, I couldn't have said it better in terms of the fact that we certainly need to open up the opportunities for voters to easily cast their ballots. However, I will have to say that it's important that voters be informed before they go to the polls. And so I encourage people, go ahead, get your absentee ballot now, but wait until closer to election day to actually cast that ballot, because things can happen between now and then. One, you as a voter may become a whole lot more informed about the issues that are going to be on the ballot. You may not have studied them yet. You may not have read the League of Women Voters Voters Guide yet. So wait until you feel like you are a well-informed voter before you actually cast that absentee ballot.
And what should voters be doing during this early voting period to make sure their vote isn't disputed? Well, Stephen, what are you telling voters?
The best thing, check your local with your local Board of Elections, either calling them or by checking their website, and make sure that you are registered. If you don't have access to the web, you can simply call and check to make sure that your registration is up to date. So those are the steps that it's pretty simple to find out if you are. If it's updated, but if you have any doubts,
just call in. All right?
Just call in or re-register.
Thank you so much, Stephen Hightower. He's the director of the League for Youth Voters in Ohio. We were also joined also joining us was Mary Wilson, president of the League for Women Voters. Thank you so much. I'm Cheryl Corley, and this is News and Notes. 15 years ago, Will Allen started growing vegetables on a couple of acres in a rundown area on the north side of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A handful of teenagers pitched in to help him till the soil. These days, his urban farming nonprofit, Growing Power, has 40 acres just outside the city and satellite operations in Chicago. He produces everything from beets to freshwater fish for both low-income folks and for the fanciest restaurants in town. The MacArthur Foundation just awarded Will Allen one of its genius grants for his innovative approach to urban food production and community development. And he joins me now. Hi, Will.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, back in the 1960s, people talked about getting back to the land. And you show with your work that you really don't have to flee the city to reconnect with the food on your plate. You've been at this since the mid-1990s. And I was wondering how you've seen people's attitudes towards food change during that time.
Well, I think what has really pushed the movement forward, even though we've been educating folks about where their food comes from and how important it is to know who your farmer is, I think these food scares with Salinas Valley and areas outside of the U.S. with the food that have made a lot of people sick has really pushed this to the forefront, mm-hmm. where people really want to know where their food comes from. They want to connect back to the earth. Because it's a very important thing, because most families in America had folks that were growing food at some time or another in history. So I think there's a huge renaissance now in folks wanting to grow food, wanting to connect with farmers markets and other farmers that are growing food and bringing it into the city. And with more people moving into our cities worldwide, we have to figure out how we're going to grow food closer to where people live. Because we really do have a worldwide food crisis, mm-hmm. and we have a crisis in this country, especially with the financial situation right now. The first place people cut back is food, and it really affects the most vulnerable, which is our youth and our seniors.
Mm-hmm. Well, your organization, Growing Power, has a weekly market basket where low-income folks receive a regular selection of fresh produce from your operation. So what are folks getting in their box this week?
Well, this week they're getting greens, mixed salad greens, broccoli, tomatoes, onions. They're getting apples and pears, squash, yellow squash, cucumbers, parsley, sweet potatoes, carrots, and kale. So they get sometimes up to 16 items for $16, and it's about a $25 retail price. That they're receiving. So they're getting a great deal. It's farm prices. Mm-hmm. We can drop this bag of food into any food desert community, places where there are no grocery stores. It's available regardless of your economic means. So I really wanted to create a program that wasn't a program just for a particular group, but was available for everybody, because everybody should have access to the same good food. Mm-hmm. And currently, we don't have that situation anywhere in the world. So we really need to start thinking about how do we heal ourselves and how do we I really think that we could cut our health care costs in half if people ate healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the grant that you just won, the MacArthur Foundation grants go mostly to artists and academics and scientists. So I was wondering what your reaction was when you got that phone call and what you're going to do with the grant.
Well, quite frankly, I was quite surprised. I look at it as not just a recognition of myself, but many people like me who've been providing food, and where food in this country was never, food producers weren't looked at on the same level as doctors and lawyers and different occupations. So I think it's really a recognition, and it'll really help push this movement forward so people start eating healthier. And because I've gotten a tremendous amount of attention once I got this award, much more than before, but mm-hmm. I think it really will help all of us food producers and people that are involved in the food system movement.
Well, you teach workshops to aspiring urban farmers, and I was wondering what's happening in communities of color. Are you seeing a lot of interest in urban food production? Has that been increasing?
Yeah, it's been a big change, because, and it's really happened with our youth, as we go into different communities around the country, actually having this model in Milwaukee of our urban farm, which is a 3-acre farm that we do about 60 different things, from raising fish on a pretty large scale to growing compost, because all of our soil inside cities is contaminated. So that's one of the first things you have to do if you're going to grow food, is to grow healthy soil. Kids have really gotten involved. The schools, kids inside cities really don't have that much to do positive in terms of things like learning about developing life skills around growing food. So it's really been a tremendous response that started with the kids, and now it's moving into more of a multi-generational kind of a concept that everybody wants to know. Everybody wants to get back to growing food. And, you know, people of color are affected the most because of the fact that all the processed foods that we're taking in, our bodies can't really metabolize that. And it's really an opportunity for us to really show our kids about where their food comes from, introduce them to something different than going out and getting processed-type foods that really don't do that much for their system.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Will.
Thank you.
That was urban farmer Will Allen. He founded the agricultural nonprofit Growing Power and is a MacArthur Foundation Fellow for 2008. Now we are going to follow how that city-grown produce ends up on your plate with a young chef and author committed to local urban food systems. Bryant Terry is the co-author of Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen, and author of the forthcoming Vegan Soul Kitchen. He's also a regular contributor on TheRoot.com. So thanks for joining us, Bryant.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're working towards some of the same goals as Will Allen. Tell us a bit about how you became interested in food as a social justice issue.
Well, I was in New York City at NYU in graduate school in history. And at the time, I was doing a lot of research on social movements in the mid-20th century and came across a lot of the projects that the Black Panthers were running in West Oakland, California. And the ones that interested me the most were their grocery giveaways and their free breakfast for children program. And having been an activist and doing a lot of work in New York City around racial justice, economic rights issues, I felt that food justice was a big piece missing from this overall analysis around social justice, and I wanted to bring that in. And I thought that cooking would be a great way to engage young people about these more political issues around health, food, and agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Well, you now live in Oakland, California, and our previous guest, Will Allen, and other food activists often describe inner cities as food deserts with few grocery options, just a corner of stores maybe stocked with processed food, some cigarettes, some booze. Is that a problem in Oakland, or how are things changing there?
Well, it's certainly not a problem throughout Oakland, but there are certain impacted neighborhoods that are dealing with having an inordinate amount of corner stores that sell processed packaged foods, low in nutrients, and lots of alcohol and cigarettes, and that don't have grocery stores. This West Oakland, California, is a community that has close to 30,000 residents, and they have 53 liquor stores and not one single grocery store. Hmm. And this is something that we see in impacted communities throughout the United States. But thankfully, we have organizations like Growing Power and the People's Grocery working in West Oakland who are working to address these issues and bring more healthy food into the communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have roots in the South. So what are some of the food prep and food producing traditions of the South that you think we need to reconnect with?
Yeah, for me, it's really about helping people remember and, as you said, reconnect with these issues or these ways of connecting with the land and producing our food that we saw just a couple of generations ago. As Will Allen said, you know, most people in America were producing their own food. And when I think about the African-American community that I grew up in, you know, my grandparents had practically an urban farm in their backyard. You know, everyone on the street was growing some type of food, small plots. People had mini orchards. And you go back to the same neighborhood now, and it's, you know, practically a shell of itself. And I think we need to just kind of, like, remember that the way that people are advocating for eating healthy, local, sustainable food, you know, these are ways that many of us were eating, and specifically around African Americans. I think that a couple of generations ago, a lot of us were eating this way, and we just need to get back to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, some argue that the locally sourced organic food movement is elitist and out of reach for the budget of lower-income city folks. So what do you think?
Well, I think that that speaks to the need for there to be more locally-driven, locally-owned production of healthy food. Obviously, if people are going to some of the big corporate health food stores or supermarkets, the foods are going to be more expensive. But, you know, as we see with Growing Power, the organization that Will Allen started, you know, these organizations find ways to produce food and make them affordable for low-income residents and people, you know, some of the most vulnerable populations. But I think what we cannot do is solely rely on organizations with the specific aim of bringing healthy food into urban centers. You know, we need to bring in faith-based institutions, existing community-based organizations that often have financial capital, land on which food can be grown, and people to actually implement these projects to get on this, because we need to be producing a lot more food in cities, and I think that's a great way to, you know, help affect that.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I want to put your cooking skills at work.
Okay.
You heard what was going out in Will Allen's market basket this week. Lots of vegetables.
Yes.
So give us some ideas on how you would turn that produce into a dish.
You know, much of my focus these days is on preparing simple yet artful dishes made from sustainable foods, kind of influenced by one of my mentors, Alice Waters. And, you know, the first thing that I thought about when I heard Will talking about the box was the kale and the sweet potatoes. And I would probably simply make a soup with some of those fresh greens and then add the sweet potatoes. And something easy to make. It's something that could be stretched out over a couple of days or even frozen and eaten later. And, you know, nutrient-dense and healthy.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about this new book you have coming out soon called Vegan Soul Kitchen. So a lot of people might not put those two things together. So how do you do that, and how do you convince people that you can have soul food and it's vegan soul food?
You know, I was hesitant about the term vegan because I think for a lot of people it evokes granola and fake meat products. And for me, the book is less about the absence of meat and more about the emphasis on fresh, local, sustainable, nutrient-dense vegetables and fruits and whole grains and, you know, just real food that I think so many of us are disconnected from. And as I talked about my history, my familial kind of connection to food, when I think about the food that my grandparents ate and their parents and my parents ate, it was comprised of a lot of food that was as local as a backyard garden, as fresh as being harvested right before the meal, and, you know, nutrient-dense greens and tubers and fresh fruits. And I think that this is a legacy that African Americans have that isn't often talked about, and the focus is often on the comfort foods, you know, the soul food, which people, you know, have come to understand as African-American cuisine, but it's much more rich and diverse, and I'm trying to really help people remember that.
All right. Well, we'll be looking out for that. Thank you so much for joining us, Bryant.
Thank you.
That was eco-chef and food justice advocate Bryant Terry. He is the co-author of Grub, Ideas for an Urban Organic Kitchen, and author of the forthcoming Vegan Soul Kitchen. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, sat down with Farai Chidea.
Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Farai. How's it going?
Things are great. So what are listeners saying this week?
Well, we got a letter about an interview we did with Tim Wise about an essay he wrote on white privilege. Aljorie Stallings in Glen Burnie, Maryland, wrote us this. Mr. Wise is completely dead on about all the hypocritical points made as it relates to race and this election. I'm aware that black folks like myself find this viewpoint very, very refreshing at a time like this, particularly as elements of coverage of this election makes it seem like race and how situations are viewed is the pink elephant in the room.
Ben Manning Walker in Hanover, Indiana, wrote in. He heard our blogger Anthony Bradley say this about an effigy of Senator Barack Obama found at a Christian university in Oregon.
There's something troubling about the fact that even in so-called Christian community, there is this default mode where youngsters have learned that you protest against blacks by hanging a rope around a black man's neck. And my sense is that they've learned those things from the elders, because in Christian circles, it remains one of the last bastions of America where you can be a racist and a Christian, and sadly, that won't get challenged too much.
Manning wrote, sadly, I don't believe the matter is quite so simple. Monotheist fundamentalism, be it Christian, Jewish, or Islamic, has become increasingly toxic for both politics and populations. Not only are racism and sexism rampant in extremist interpretations of the Abrahamic tradition, but these extremist sects also feel an ethical compulsion to force their voices into the public discourse at rates far greater than represent their actual demographics.
Then Bill in Oakland, California, wrote in to say he doesn't like hearing conservative commentary on our show. He wrote, "I began listening to the show as an alternative to the monolithic conservative spin machine. To hear a substantial part of each show now devoted to this hot air is off-putting, to say the least. I also object to the increasing dominance of vapid, insubstantial opinion spin, stories about the media, et al., that already dominate the rest of the media."
And finally, Kamlin Togovi wrote us this. "Your show is great. I listen to it every chance I get while I'm in my car. I live in the Baltimore, Maryland area, and to see a strong and intelligent black woman heading such an enterprise is quite remarkable. We need more shows on mainstream media that challenge perceptions of what black is. Keep up the great and important work that you and your crew are doing." And I want to say thank you, Kamlin.
And thanks for your letters. Please keep your comments coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That was NPR's Farai Chidea speaking with News and Notes editor Sasha Woodruff.